Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. Delighted to introduce episode 2467 to you and our guest, James Esses, who has for quite some time been a campaigner on behalf of free speech and has had a great deal to say about gender ideology, which I happen to think is one of the most important issues in society today. He's coming to us from the UK. And James, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom. Nice to speak to you.
Before we talk about the Declaration for Biological Reality, maybe you might contextualize all this with a bit of information about your own background, because we actually don't know each other, and right. I've kind of deliberately stayed away from finding out too much about you, because I prefer to let you tell people your story. So how did you come to be associated with this, I guess, this cause, more or less?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it kind of took me by surprise. My background is in law, criminal attorney in the UK, and then working in the civil service and the public sector. And I then started to do some training in psychotherapy, and I started volunteering as a children's counselor at a charity over here. And I began to think that actually maybe I wanted to kind of transition into that as a vocation. But during this time, I was speaking to children, telling me that they were trapped in the wrong body, that they wanted to take puberty blockers, that one day these young girls wanted to go on and have their breasts removed so that they could become males. And, you know, I was becoming really quite concerned hearing this. And so I read up on what was going on clinically, and I became even more concerned. And essentially, I felt that I had to speak out at some point on behalf of kind of psychotherapists, actually, who have been complicit in a lot of this harm. And I'm sure we'll get onto that. So I started to speak out. I wrote a petition to the UK government on the issue. I wrote some articles. And then something that kind of catapulted me into notoriety was that the institution that I was studying my master's degree in, my master's degree in psychotherapy, they expelled me one day out of the blue because of my advocacy on this topic. And I'm currently embroiled in litigation against them for that.
Oh, good heavens. Well, it's very interesting to me how many groups that describe themselves as marginalized have no idea what it really is like to be marginalized. You know, I've very often said, you know, try to walk in my shoes for 10 minutes or your shoes and for 10 minutes. I don't think they'd make it. So in some ways, I think your story is not all that different from, apart from the degree of your involvement, from that of a lot of people who, you know, probably would have gone through their lives never really looking into gender theory if it hadn't come to touch them so closely in that it's being imposed on their kids in schools. It's all over the media. And it's being portrayed as the kind of cause that a good person supports. You know, the side of the quote-unquote transitioners. This is where the good people are. And most people don't want to be thought of as haters. They don't want to be thought of as bad people. They don't want to be thought of as people who say no. So I think a lot of people go along because it's the path of least resistance. And it's difficult to stand up to it. I'm looking on my computer at something called the Declaration for Biological Reality, which can be found at declarationforbiologicalreality.org, that pushes back against some of what we've been hearing in, well, coming out of the universities and in the mainstream culture quite a bit. How did this declaration come about? What, did you have a role in it?
Yes, I essentially set up and coordinated that. And that was as much out of frustration as anything else, wanting to try and push back against this narrative in society that you just alluded to, you know, essentially encouraging people to transition, encouraging people to use pronouns, encouraging companies to allow men to use female toilets, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of got together with quite a diverse group of people, politicians from all sides of the political spectrum, children's rights campaigners, lawyers, social workers, therapists, psychologists, to try and send a message to the UK government to please stop this. You know, and we've made a series of demands in that declaration. We put it out for signature. I think last count, we've got well over 20,000 signatures. You know, we kept it kind of UK focused. But once I launched that, I've had people from abroad, including in the States, saying that they would like to join forces on setting up their own version of this. I mean, really, you could probably create some sort of global declaration because these issues are happening everywhere.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, because there's no UK in the domain name, I didn't immediately realize it was UK-based, except because of the English spelling, let's say. Now, we're hearing over here, am I getting this right, that in the UK there's been a decision against the use of, what is it, specifically puberty blockers in children?
That's right. The English National Health Service has said that they will no longer be prescribing puberty blockers. The caveat is outside of the context of clinical research trials. So there clearly is some thought that they want to actually conduct some research into this medication, which I'm not particularly pleased about because I don't want any child to suffer. But, you know, if this is what it's going to take to actually get this stuff eradicated once and for all, then I can live with this. But yes, I mean, it's a pretty groundbreaking statement from the National Health Service. It only applies to England because of the way the health system is governed in the UK. So, for example, in Scotland, it doesn't apply to them.
I see. Right. Okay. Okay. Well, better than nothing.
Yes.
But one of the aspects of this that I think we need to confront is that the side of the argument that is in favor of these interventions into the medical interventions into the lives of young people, telling them that they may have been born in the wrong body and all the usual propaganda, is that they claim that in fact they have science on their side and that we are science deniers. And they'll cite this study or that study. They'll cite this gender studies expert. The problem here is twofold. One, I think we have entire academic disciplines that are really just advocacy rather than true academic disciplines. So to say that somebody is an expert in a particular field does not impress me. But secondly, we have to confront the claim that if we don't affirm young people in what they believe their gender identity to be, then we are responsible if they then go ahead and commit suicide. Now, you're familiar with these types of things. What do you say about what I've just said?
Well, I think, you know, the core position we need to always come back to is that, and there is no doubt about this, so this isn't actually up for debate as much as people would like it to be, but sex is binary and immutable. You know, I saw a tweet put out by Richard Dawkins earlier on today with making that, you know, that very point. What these activists have done quite strategically and cleverly is that they've drawn this distinction between biological sex on one hand and gender identity on the other. And they say gender identity is completely subjective. It is completely down to the individual. You cannot deny anyone else's gender identity. And this level of subjectivity makes it very, very difficult to engage with. So I think we need to constantly come back to the science on the topic. Your point around suicidality, I mean, yes, I'm reading things left, right, and center. I've spoken to parents who went to see clinicians because their child was saying they were trapped in the wrong body, and they were essentially told, well, you know, would you rather have a trans child or a dead child? And, you know, that type of scaremongering, that type of politicizing of suicide really is quite disgraceful. I mean, you know, it's, for one, it's not that simple. You know, suicide can rarely be linked to one specific issue. It's a very complex area. And so to try and kind of impute suicidality on this basis, I think is completely improper. But again, to try and scare parents into letting their kids transition. And again, I spoke to a parent recently who believed this, and they thought, well, I want my kid to stay alive. So they actually allowed their child to transition. And they said to me that since they've transitioned, their child has never been more suicidal, has never been more miserable and depressed. So it's a complete and utter lie that's been peddled here.
But it needs to be confronted because virtually Yes. Everybody believes it, I think even people who are on, shall we say, our side of the argument, I think they feel very much on the defensive because they've heard this argument repeated again and again. So it's definitely got to be addressed. About maybe 3 weeks ago, I had Jennifer Lahl on my program, who had just completed a documentary that chronicled the experiences of about maybe five young men who had, quote unquote, transitioned. And in the course of that conversation, we noted that as time goes on, by far the most significant opponents of what's being done here will be people who've gone through the experience themselves, given all these false promises about what it would do for them and do for their mental health, and then desperately come back to reality.
Yes. And I think that, I mean, some might say, you know, it's medical negligence, clinical negligence. I don't know if negligence does it justice, actually. I think we're moving into the territory of recklessness and or potentially intent. I think a lot of these clinicians know exactly what they're doing. Again, in the United Kingdom, the Tavistock, which was the kind of National Health Service's gender clinic, it's been shut down, thankfully, after years of whistleblowing and safeguarding concerns. But it was reported in the news that some of the clinicians there who were pushing puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones on young, vulnerable patients, you know, will receive kind of significant payouts after their work comes to an end. Undoubtedly, there's a huge amount of money to be made in this space. There's a surgeon called Dr. Sive Gallagher, who originates shamefully from Ireland. And actually, it makes me feel sickened to be an Irishman when she is in the same sentence as me. But she is over in the United States performing what she's calling gender affirmation procedures, essentially removing healthy breasts and genitals of young people. And she's making a lot of money out of this. And I think it's disgusting. And, you know, for people like that, not only should they be struck off whatever medical register they belong to, my own opinion is they need to be prosecuted.
It's funny that some of these very same people will, of course, turn up their noses and laugh at the superstitious backwardness of the Middle Ages. And yet they turn around and do insane things like this that any clear-headed person in the Middle Ages would have known there was something wrong with. Now, over in the United States, I can say that what's particularly astonishing is the rate at which this kind of fanaticism has overtaken, let's say, the fields of child psychology and psychiatry. I mean, to the point where people who are issuing cautionary words or words of outright opposition are very much on the defensive and in a minority. And this seems to have happened with shocking rapidity. And I wonder if the same experience, I assume the same thing has happened over there?
Oh, exactly the same. Primarily because all of the main regulatory accreditation bodies for therapists and psychologists and even psychiatrists in the UK have all been ideologically captured. They're very much pushing this stuff onto their members. Also in the UK, we've had this whole ongoing debate around conversion therapy, and the government are seeking to ban conversion therapy. Now, when most people think of conversion therapy, they think of things like electric shock treatment or corrective rape. You know, shamefully, some of these techniques were practiced in times gone by. Thankfully, now they're all illegal. But trans rights activists are trying to argue that actually there are therapists, counselors, therapists, talking therapists out there who are engaging in conversion therapy simply by just having a conversation with a client. And that a therapist who does not affirm a client into transitioning may be a conversion therapist. And so this language has now entered into the dialogue and the narrative over here. And again, that's caused a real chilling effect because therapists, and I know many who are too afraid to speak out against this because they're worried that they're going to be labeled as a conversion therapist and it's going to destroy their reputation and their livelihood.
Very happy to thank our sponsor, Factor. Mealtime can be stressful. You're busy, you want to eat well, but you're tired. You can't bear the idea of dirtying up the kitchen yet again. Maybe you don't have the ingredients you need. And then you're tempted to just go ahead and order food you know you probably shouldn't eat. And you struggle with this every single day. Well, Factor is a great solution. With over 35 different options a week to choose from to have delivered straight to your door, including keto, calorie smart, vegan and veggie, and more, It's easier than ever to have a week's worth of meals ready to go, no stress. Pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Factor's restaurant quality meals are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. You'll discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Factor's delicious meals are less expensive than takeout, and it's good for you. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, upscale options done easily. And there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. Factor meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Go to factormeals.com/woods50 and use code WOODS50 to get 50% off. That's code WOODS50 at factormeals.com/woods50 to get 50% off. In the U.S., I can say that in so many cases, not just in gender theory, but in so many aspects of our society, it's like words mean the exact opposite what they, you know, what the dictionary definition indicates. I mean, just this week, maybe it hasn't, I hope it hasn't gotten all the way over to where you are, but for heaven's sake, Donald Trump, not everybody's favorite person, but, you know, if he says something, it should be fairly reported. And he was at a rally and he said that if he's not elected, that there is going to be a bloodbath in the automobile industry. And bloodbath can mean like literally people being killed. But when you talk about the automobile industry, you probably don't mean that. What he means is there'll be a very, very bad period of suffering and deprivation in that area. And the media has spent the entire weekend explaining that he must mean that he's threatening a bloodbath if he's not reelected. Even though you can read the passage, and the whole passage is about his trade theory, which is all wrong, but the whole passage is about Mexico and China, and if somebody doesn't stand up to them, it's going to be a bloodbath. And so we have to now, instead of being a normal society where we could spend some time talking about trade policy and whether he's right about that or not, we have to spend a week now arguing about the meaning of the word bloodbath. That's not normal. That's not normal. We should be talking about an actual thing. And we can't talk about an actual thing. We have to instead talk about minutiae and the shades of meanings of words.
I completely agree. I mean, it's all a kind of pathetic distraction. But this is what comes when we live in a world in which we're being told that words are literal violence and also that it pays to be a victim. And these two things come together in quite a dangerous way. And so we've got people now on the lookout for words they don't like and are quite often imputing the worst possible intent behind those words as well. I'm currently writing an expose I'm going to be releasing this week on a major newspaper in the United Kingdom and their diversity and inclusion policy that they're pushing on their journalists and their staff members. There's a whole section on microaggressions. And, you know, I can't really believe what I'm seeing. Supposedly, this is a microaggression, and this is without any context whatsoever, but it is a microaggression for a white person to say to a black person, let's say after a work presentation, you're really articulate. That is seen as a microaggression.
That's right, because that implies that it's unusual for a black person to be articulate.
Correct, correct. Yeah. And it doesn't matter what the intent was. It doesn't matter what the context is. That is simply a microaggression. Again, people are looking for other ways to be offended. In this same document, It says that if there was a fancy dress party and somebody wore a sombrero, that they need to make a public apology in the workplace for having engaged in cultural misappropriation. I mean, this is the kind of crazy world we're living in today.
Yeah, yeah. In the same way that I saw some people on St. Patrick's Day saying, look, you know what? Go ahead, appropriate my culture. I want you to. It's a sign of love and respect. I want you to. I want you to enjoy St. Patrick's Day. You know, I would like to see more Mexicans say, you know, it's kind of flattering that you're interested in our culture. You know, if you ignored us, there would be people who would also pretend to be offended by that. Why don't we just all forget all this? And anyway, I want to quote from the declaration here in the section on women. I mean, It is incredible to me that the women's movement, such as it is, if it even exists at this point, just sits back and lets this happen. So women in this new version of things, given that nobody can define what a woman is apart from something that you identify as, which is just a circular argument, we are now in a situation where I don't want to mention their names, but there are people in the U.S. who are obviously men. We all know that. We all know these people are men who think that being a woman means acting like a fool and skipping around in a meadow and awkwardly wearing high heels and having clownish makeup on, that's an insult to women. Like a normal woman would look at that and say, like, are you making fun of me? Like, that's what you think being a woman is? A ridiculously exaggerated, offensive version of reality. Yeah. Instead, we're supposed to just sit back and accept that and let women be called menstruators or cervix havers when, as the declaration points out, some of the men who, quote, identify as female use the terms woman and mother, which are now terms that an actual biological woman is no longer allowed to use.
Well, you know, we've heard the line, trans women are women. Okay. But I come across a lot of people online, a lot of trans activists who will use the term cisgender woman to refer to somebody who was born a woman and identifies as a woman. So if you hold both of those things together, what you're saying is a trans woman, i.e. a man, is a woman, but a woman, a biological woman, is a cisgender woman with that little prefix attached to it. So the whole thing really is quite crazy. Yeah, the other irony here, to touch upon what you just said about this kind of clownish parodying of what it means to be a woman, the people pushing this are often saying that they are ultra-liberal and what they're trying to do is push back against stereotypes and all the rest of it. They're the ones engaging in stereotypes. You know, I thought we were moving towards a world where actually we were saying, listen, men and women, they can do what they want. They can act as they want. We can have more feminine men. We can have more masculine women. You know, it's all good. But actually, essentially, they're saying, no, if you are a man who is more feminine, then actually maybe you're just a woman trapped in the wrong body. I mean, it's so totally backwards and regressive.
At the end of each section in this declaration, you have in bold various, we might as well call them demands. I mean, the other side uses the word demands all the time. Why can't we demand things? Yeah. And in particular here, in item number three, you're talking about how the public sector deals with this. And you're suggesting the public sector ought to stay out of this. The public sector should not, like public bodies, as you say, should be free from symbolism and bias grounded in gender identity ideology. Public sector workers and organizations should remain ideologically neutral and not display ideological symbols on their uniforms, buildings, or vehicles. There should never be a requirement, legal or otherwise, to use preferred pronouns or to acknowledge that someone has changed their sex. No one should ever be forced to state their preferred pronouns. Biological reality should be explicitly protected. Nobody should be reprimanded or sanctioned for holding such views. So, in other words, for holding the views that all of mankind held until about like 7 years ago or something, it's incredible how quickly they expect you to change on a dime. Like, this is fundamental to what it means to be a human being. And the way we've thought about this crosses cultures and time periods all the way to the very beginning. And we're supposed to believe that that has been absolutely wrong from the start, and that on a dime, because of a bunch of PhDs in a made-up field, we're supposed to, on a dime, believe the exact opposite, or we're bigots and haters. And I mean, that's, again, this is not normal. Like, normal people don't make demands like this. And a normal person who honestly and truly did believe these things would say something like, you know, I realize that what we're demanding of you and of society at large is quite extreme and very abrupt and sudden. And we understand that we're asking you to rethink something that really is very, very fundamental to us and that we all took for granted for a very long time. However, justice and truth demand that we re-examine these things. But not one of these people talks that way. Have you ever heard anybody talk that way in the gender ideology camp? Never, right? There's never any charity shown to the other side. The other side is all bigots and stupid and backward. They can't for one second just be charitable enough to say, I know we're asking a lot, but we're still asking it all the same. Just talk like a person.
Yes, I think that's wishful thinking, Tom.
I think that's wishful thinking, yeah.
But look, you're completely right. However, what I will say is that they played it very well, right? I think the strategy that you've just alluded to, I think actually is played very well indeed, because yeah, this is how they've managed to kind of infiltrate basic language, the lexicon, all our societal institutions, by kind of suggesting that actually this concept of gender identity has always been there since time immemorial, and possibly people were just too afraid to kind of come out and be their true selves. And now it's just being taught as if it were fact. You know, I'm coming across school books for primary school children saying to them, you know, you have a unique gender identity. It may or may not align with the sex you were assigned at birth. So they've played it very well. I've written about this as well. You know, the term LGBT, I mean, that rolls off the tongue so nicely in a way that, because it, you know, up until a few years ago, well, there was no such thing. It was just LGB. But now, if you saw something that said LGB, your brain would automatically, even subconsciously, be saying, but where's the T? So again, they played it very well. I resent having to describe my beliefs in this space as gender critical, because that suggests that actually I and others who share those beliefs are kind of some sort of outliers in some way. Whereas actually, as you've just said, this is fact, and it's the way things have always been since the beginning of time. So that's why I use the term biological reality in that declaration. I didn't call it the declaration for gender critical beliefs or whatever, because what I'm trying to get us back to is embracing reality.
Some will say that, yes, sex may be binary, but gender isn't. There's a distinction to be made between these two things. What's your thought about that?
Gender is such a kind of nebulous concept. I think everyone's got their own definition of what gender was. I think, historically, I've always seen it as a society's general beliefs about things that are more masculine or feminine in nature. But, you know, I would always come back to the point again of there is nothing wrong with exhibiting traits that are typically associated with the opposite sex. Again, this is now referring to some school books I've come across, been taught to young children, suggesting to young boys that if they like the color pink or playing with dolls, that they might actually be girls. Is it not possible simply that this is a boy who likes the color pink? Is that not a potential? So the concept of gender has kind of confused the whole thing. But again, the words are now used increasingly interchangeably. So for example, in the UK, there is a piece of law which allows somebody to apply for something called a gender recognition certificate. And that's basically saying that they have transitioned. But actually, a court in the UK recently ruled that if you receive a gender recognition certificate, that it actually changes your legal sex. So again, we're conflating these terms together, whereas actually they should be kept completely separate from one another, because we need to keep rehashing the point that you can believe whatever you want in your head, you can have whatever surgery you want, you can wear whatever clothes you want, it does not and cannot change your sex.
Indeed. So what do you think? And I hate asking people to predict things because we can't really know. But I will say that it does seem that in the US, and apparently now to some extent in the UK, as more critical attention has been paid to this and as the practices of some institutions have been exposed, and I think as the movement has become more obnoxious, frankly, there has been at least the indications that there may be some kind of a pushback. Very, very, let's say, not nearly strong enough and certainly belated.
Yeah.
But do you see that sort of thing? And do you think that ultimately this could reverse itself and maybe 50 years from now we look back on this and shake our heads at the gullibility of so many people?
I try and cling on to that as a belief, but I've become cynical and pessimistic over the last few years. I mean, undoubtedly, certain things are moving in the right direction. I mean, I see that in the States. You know, I've seen some of the legislation that's been passed in certain states around medical transitioning for children. And I'm very pleased to see things like that. But then the next day, I'll see something that Joe Biden or Kamala Harris has put out. And I think, how can we still be living in this world? Similarly, in the United Kingdom, great result with the National Health Service banning puberty blockers. But then there are workplaces up and down the country that are still allowing their male employees to use female toilets and changing rooms. So sometimes I think we're moving forward, sometimes I think we're moving backwards. I think short-term things will continue to go in a positive direction. My biggest fear now is with all of these children who have been spoon-fed this ideology in schools and then moved on and been spoon-fed it in university, you know, that those are the future leaders of tomorrow. And so there was a bit of a worry in the back of my mind that we could reverse a lot of this only for it to go right back the other direction in a few decades from now. So I spend so much of my focus actually in terms of what children are being taught in schools. Because if they're being indoctrinated from such a young age, I think that spells danger in our future collectively.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And that's part of why, but not exclusively why, I'm so critical of the educational establishment. The other thing I worry about is, again, in the United States, that's the only place I can speak about, but the law schools in the United States are increasingly turning out more and more activist legal minds. That is to say, there was still, I think, an old-fashioned clinging to the idea that even if before me is a case involving somebody who represents a cause I like and somebody who represents one I despise, that nevertheless, the law is blind and I will do my best to apply abstract legal principles to the facts of the case. There's at least lip service to that. And I think even in reality, sometimes that was still observed. Whereas today, this is the sense is that the purpose of the law is to impose your worldview on people you despise. In the same way that the Bolsheviks, they knew how a legal case was supposed to come out because they knew that the oppressor was supposed to be defeated by the oppressed. And then they would simply reason backward from there. And I think that's what's happening. And the law, of course, is a way of revolutionizing a society. And through the law, you can take what is still a minority ideology, like gender theory. I mean, let's face it, there are a lot of very loud activists and a lot of people who go along out of fear, but it's still a minority ideology being forced on the whole society.
Yes.
The law is an extraordinarily powerful instrument for imposing that on society, imposing it on families, making life difficult to impossible for family members who dissent from what's being done to a child. So I worry also about the law schools particularly.
No, legislation has certainly enabled a lot of this. And I agree with your point around kind of activist lawyers and even members of the judiciary. We've actually seen that over in the UK around a lot of these climate change activists who are kind of bringing society to a standstill. I saw recently there was a kind of joint letter penned by a variety of lawyers who said that they will not, out of conscience, prosecute these environmental activists. And similarly, we've seen some of them go on trial and judges have come down extremely leniently on them in a way that they wouldn't were it another cause. So I am worried about the kind of politicization of the legal profession as well. But I think we need to try and turn the weapon that is the law to our advantage as much as possible. And that's why I'm bringing this litigation for my own expulsion. I have a number of colleagues and advocates over in the UK who have successfully fought legal battles. And I think, you know, in some ways that might be the only way we can really turn these things around, actually, is by forcing institutions to accept and acknowledge reality once again, because I don't think they're going to do it of their own volition.
Big thanks to our sponsor, Federated Computer. A lot of us are tired of being under the thumb of creepy big tech. And a great way to get out from under the thumb of creepy big tech is to stop using their quote-unquote free tools. Yeah, they're free, all right. They're free because they're harvesting your data and manipulating you as a consumer. Federated Computer, on the other hand, offers a full replacement for Google, Microsoft Office 365, Slack, Zoom, and more for people who care about privacy. Everything's encrypted end-to-end, fully backed up daily. We're talking private email, file storage, team chat, WordPress hosting, CRM, help desk, email marketing tools, and more, all bundled up in one easy monthly subscription. You get unlimited users without your price going up and fantastic customer support from, guess what, actual human beings. Their solutions are powered by open source software so you can take your data wherever you like, whenever you like. So how about that? A company that thinks its job is to provide you with services rather than being your parents. So take your first steps toward digital freedom. Visit federated.computer/woods today for your free 30-day trial. That's federated.computer/woods for your free 30-day trial. Are you able to give us a little bit of background about your case, or do you have to be quiet about it, or what?
I've been speaking out about it for so long that the time for being quiet is long gone.
I'd love to hear the background to it.
Yeah, so as I said, I had started this petition to the government. I had raised concerns with my therapeutic regulatory body, basically saying, as therapists, we should not be encouraging irreversible medicalization of children for a mental health condition. That was kind of the crux of the argument. I was saying it went against child safeguarding. My institution, clear believers of gender ideology, did not like that. And so I received this email out of the blue one day telling me that I was being expelled with immediate effect because I brought them into disrepute. And that was it. They had blocked my university email account. I couldn't access the internal policies. There was no hearing. There was no appeal. They publicized my expulsion on Twitter for everyone to see. When I finally got hold of the policies and I was looking through the circumstances in which they can expel someone summarily without a hearing, it included such misconduct as sexually assaulting a colleague on campus. So they were essentially equating my beliefs on gender with sexual assault. And so now I'm fighting them in something called the Employment Tribunal over here, and I'm suing them on the basis of discrimination against my beliefs. And I've been fighting this for the last 3 years. I've had to crowdfund the litigation. I've raised about £130,000 to date from thousands of concerned members of the public. I was also suing the largest regulatory body for therapists in the UK. They're called the UK Council for Psychotherapy. And I recently settled out of court with them. And they published a very good statement, essentially saying for the first time, they recognize that beliefs such as mine are completely valid for professional therapists to hold. So I'm now just waiting for a trial date, essentially, against my former institution. But I'm looking forward very much to having my day in court.
It is unbelievable what people have been put through over this. Absolutely unbelievable. But so now let me, though, play devil's advocate. Here's a devil's advocate question you sometimes hear from the what people who call themselves the live and let live people would say. Yeah. They would say, look, if some people in society believe this ideology and they even follow through with it, with the medical interventions and stuff, that's their problem, you know, and if it does turn out to be a bad thing for them, well, that's for them to confront. Why should it bother you at all? Does it affect you personally?
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I say that the entire premises of gender ideology requires actions from the rest of us and requires other people's rights to be infringed upon. If a man identifying as a woman wants to be able to use female toilets or compete in female sports, that's having a direct impact on the women involved. Similarly, if we are being encouraged or even requested to obey pronouns or even to offer up our own pronouns at the start of every conversation, that is impacting upon us as individuals. But holistically, and I predominantly come at this from a kind of philosophical therapeutic perspective, human beings flourish when they embrace reality. And it might be painful at times because there's a lot about life that's pretty awful, a lot of uncertainty. We don't know what our purpose is. We don't know when we're going to die, you know, X, Y, Z. But we should embrace reality at all costs. And so I wouldn't believe that I was doing my proper ethical practice as a therapist if I am encouraging or enabling a kind of mass societal delusion.
Yeah, that's what it is. And I don't want to enable, and I don't want to necessarily solicit your opinions on a topic I didn't invite you to speak on. I don't want to put you on the spot. But that's why it irritates me at this stage to see people still wearing masks, because I feel like what was done during COVID was anti-scientific and extremely disruptive to society. And I don't even want to give the impression that I consented to that. And so when I still run into people, it's like they have to, it's like I cannot get over the analysis of a friend of mine who said that when we were all in school, we remember the popular crowd. These were kids who, they would do anything to be in that popular crowd. They would think or say or do whatever they needed to think or say or do, or wear whatever brand of shoes they were supposed to wear, whatever it was. Above all, they had to be in that popular crowd. And that instinct has followed them throughout life when it comes to their political views. They can't imagine holding a view that their favorite singer doesn't hold, or that the actors on TV don't hold, or that the newscaster doesn't hold, or that most of the political class, they can't imagine that. It would never, and so it's not even like they consciously say, I better adopt their views. It's that this is the way their brain has worked forever, is that I have to let everybody know that I'm part of this group, because the worst thing that could happen to me is to be expelled from this popular group. Whereas that's the benefit of being a nerd your whole life. I was never part of the popular group, so none of this ever entered my mind.
I'm with you there, Tom. I also fall into that category. So much of this is nothing more than fashionable trends. People don't really engage in the proper reflection or the research to actually upskill themselves on the things that they're talking about. It's just whatever's trendy or whatever will give them an easy life. You know, generally people just want to keep their head down. You know, they don't want to put their head above the parapet. I mean, on the COVID stuff, I fundamentally believe in free speech and open debate. I do see people being vilified if they are saying, for example, I believe that a COVID vaccine harmed me. I've seen parents be vilified for speaking out against lockdown and saying that actually this has done real harm to their children's well-being, you know, being trapped at home, not able to go to school, et cetera, and all the rest of it. So I'm keen to have all views in this space aired. But what I'm seeing with the COVID thing, again, is free speech being shut down and people simply being labeled as intolerant or bigots simply for speaking their own opinion.
the past few years would have gone so much better if all of us could just have talked to each other.
Yes.
Without anybody getting in the way. Let's talk to each other. And maybe some of us are crazy, you know, but then just show me. And I absolutely have changed my opinion on things when the evidence has been brought to me. I absolutely have. I have record of it. I do that. I just want it to be brought to me. But if you just silence me, then that does not make me conclude I must be wrong. That does not make me conclude that I must be wrong. So the website I've been looking at today, as I said, is declarationforbiologicalreality.org. Now, I'll link to that. That is a mouthful, but I will link to that in the description of the video and also at tomwoods.com/2467. But is there anything else? Do you have a personal site or anything that talks about your case or anything like that that I can also link to?
Yes, there'd be two other sites to link to. The first is it's called a crowd justice page. That's basically my crowdfunding page for my litigation. And people can go on and donate there. And I provide regular updates as the litigation progresses. So that's one. And the other one is Substack. I've got a Substack. I write weekly articles. They're not behind a paywall. Recently, I've been focusing in on kind of exposés. I get contacted by whistleblowers from a lot of companies, particularly in the UK, who want to talk out about what's going on inside their organization and the kind of policies that have been pushed on them, these kind of woke policies. So I write regular exposés there. So people can also find my writing there. And equally, people want to follow me on X or Twitter. I mean, I'm increasingly addicted to that platform, much to my wife's displeasure. But I spend a lot of time on there. So,
what's your Twitter handle?
It's just James S's, E-S-S-E-S.
Okay, at James S. Because I'll also link to that. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. You know, it's so funny. I'm a fairly affable, easygoing guy here on the Tom Woods Show. But there's something about that platform that makes me not as affable. And so I now have daughters who are old enough to be reading my Twitter feed. And they've said, you know, Dad, if people drew their entire opinions of you based on what they saw of you on Twitter, they would have a completely misleading picture of you as a person. I don't know what that thing does to me, but anyway, so I'll link to all this stuff, Substack, crowdfunding. You'll send me those links.
I'm Google, yes.
Okay. And I'll put those up along with your Twitter. Well, thanks so much for your time. I hope we can get, you know, a few clicks over there to the declaration and also for people to get information about your particular situation. So thanks so much again, James.
Thanks very much, Tom. Nice chatting.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.